As we mentioned before the news, it has been a very difficult and turbulent week in the United States, seeing lots of scenes which would be difficult to tolerate at the best of times, but particularly given the environment that there is there at the moment. We are joined now on the line by Professor Charles Gallagher. He is the professor and chair of the Departments of Sociology and Criminal Justice, at LaSalle University in Philadelphia. Charles, good morning. Thank you very much for taking our call, because I know it's early in the morning where you are, so really do appreciate your time. First of all, just your reflections on what we've seen in the last week in the United States, and to the extent, if any, that it differs from what we've seen in the past.
Well, good morning, Gavin. Nice, thanks to be back. It's just been horrific here in the United States. It's just, it's been heartbreaking. And I believe that it is different in some ways than the Michael Brown killing that took place 5 years ago. I think many people felt that that would have been the start of reforms with our police, but like so many other false starts, it trickled out. I have never in my life seen the kind of social movement and social protest by people, and I mean now white people, white middle class people. In my city of Philadelphia, we had an enormous tens of thousands of people marching yesterday. The first time in my life I've seen police officers taking a knee. Typically, police officers here are cracking heads. And so what we're seeing now are police officers that are taking a knee, and I think taking the knee is a form of empathy, but I think it's also symbolic that many police officers feel what they saw is beyond the pale of kneeling on someone's neck for 9 minutes and pushing the life out of them. So I'd like to believe that the police reforms that are so long in coming are gonna happen.
Does it feel like it might be a little bit of a false dawn as far as that goes, though? Because it seems, and maybe your perception is different, but as a slightly dispassionate observer from another side of the world, it's very difficult, aside from those a few instances of police taking a knee rather than, you know, just cracking down on riots, it doesn't seem all that different from the other side of the world, and that maybe hopes of there being a societal sea change in this could be a little premature.
Well, I think you're right, and I am not blinded by kind of a glimmer of optimism. I think, though, here in the States, it's just been so painful on top of a pandemic, and I should say a pandemic that disproportionately affects black and brown people in the United States. The rate of death for black and brown people in the United States is just so different, and I think that it's like a triple whammy we were getting here, and I think what's happened is that people are understanding we have in the United States something called qualified immunity for police officers. And it's basically a get out of jail card for when you kill someone. And I think that is now being questioned. I think the whole blue wall, that police officers never speak about other police officers in any kind of pejorative way, that is being challenged. I think more than anything is that police unions are being challenged. And these, even having these conversations, I mean, most Americans didn't know what qualified immunity was a week ago. Now they know. They also know the kind of undue influence that police unions have on reform. So you're right. I mean, what you're seeing, we are seeing police officers basically beating up peaceful protesters. And that's the image that's going around the world. And it's horrible. But already what's happening is that those police officers are being held accountable. In my Philadelphia, police officer cracked a college kid's head open. He's now off the force. The four officers that are involved are all going to be on manslaughter charges. That nothing like this has ever happened before, where police officers are literally plucked off the street almost immediately. And part of it is, thank God, that people have their phones and their phones have cameras. So the police line is that, well, it's, you know, they didn't do this. Now they're saying, well, we have a video showing you did. That has changed everything. So, you know, I don't want to sound Pollyannish, but I think that this is different. And I think it's different in some ways. The accountability comes from basically police officers having their actions recorded. I mean, I'm in a city of Philadelphia where if you're black, if you're brown, if you're gay, you had no civil rights. And that is changing. And it's only changing, not because of police behavior, but because we're seeing now what the police do, and that is different.
You've sort of preempted what I was going to put as the next question to you, which is that, is it always the case maybe that there has been this kind of behavior and that now it's just easier to document it, or do you think that there are in fact more instances of people being unfairly at the victims of heavy-handed policing?
Yeah, you know, that's an empirical question. I would answer it this way, Gavin, that I believe that police officers are better trained now than they were 30 years ago. And it really is, it comes down to what is the culture. And there's, I think, increasingly a culture of professionalism. And I think that young officers, they grow up, like I have two daughters, or college-age daughters. They understand that everything is recorded. Everything you do will be public record. And I think young officers understand that everything they do in the public sphere is going to be recorded. And I think that that's the kind of generational divide. I also think that for the most part, police officers now are better trained. They're typically better educated. Again, there's like the old school of policing was you were immune to anything because it would be the police officer's word, typically against someone that was poor and black. And we all know how that's going to play out in a court of law. So I think that there are, I don't like the bad apple analogy because, you know, there's, if you watch the video, there are four bad apples there. The officer that killed, it was state-sanctioned murder, the officer that killed this man, and the three officers that watched it happen, they're all bad apples. And the problem is, like with the unions, they defend bad officers. They're bad apples too. So the bad apple argument is like, oh, it's just one bad apple, you know, but the problem is that there are bad apples everywhere and they literally have to be taken out of the bucket. That's what has to happen.
I want to approach the question of political leadership, but I'm sort of moral, or I'm aware that I'm sort of walking on eggshells a little bit as I do so, because, you know, people might have naively assumed in other parts of the world that the election of Barack Obama in 2008 and again in 2012 would have done a lot to heal racial divides. And then people might think that Donald Trump maybe deserves some of the blame for empowering some of this. But I think, to be fair, Donald Trump, I think, got unfairly criticized because of his remarks during the week when he said that this was going to be a great day for George Floyd. He wasn't talking about job creation. He was talking about equal justice under the law for every American receiving equal treatment. And maybe it was taken slightly out of proportion. But give me your reflections on political leadership and the difference that it makes.
Well, quite honestly, we have no political leadership. And the leadership that we do have is just simply divisive. Let's remember that this president started his campaign with wanting to execute, right, the joggers, the Central Park joggers. Every single one of those young black men was innocent. Of course, he spent a ton of money, full page out of the New York Times, to execute them. Hmm. He started his presidential campaign by insisting that President Barack Obama was not born in the United States. He's a birther. He has a history of racism in the housing market. So we have a president that has disparaged brown people, black people. He is, quite honestly, in my life, I've never seen someone that is so divisive, that has no sense of empathy. I'm sure you saw, the world saw this photo op where he literally cleared the area in front of the White House with tear gas so he could have a photo op. The fact is that this president deserves everything that he gets because he is a failed leader. He failed with the pandemic. He has not yet to make a statement in any way that has tried to unite Americans to understand the pain that's happening. He used George Floyd only to talk about the stock market. So this president, I mean, I was in the UK for 6 months on a Fulbright, and the way that people talked about Barack Obama was one of admiration and respect. There's a reason why around the world this president is so disrespected. He is incapable of connecting with normal people. He has no empathy, and he's a narcissist. So we are we have the pandemic happening. We have protests everywhere, and we don't have anyone that has any sense of a moral compass. It's disheartening. And again, I think this is across the political aisle. I mean, people are turning. Republicans are turning on this president for all the right reasons. There is no leadership in the United States right now.
But I guess then the flip side to that is that for before President Trump was in charge, we'd had an African-American president for 8 years. And although he was, you know, clearly on another side of the debate and clearly had much more sympathy towards the victims in instances like this, he wasn't able to heal much either. I wonder, is America healable? Because, you know, even if you're looking for moral leadership, that it's such a fractured country with so many different wings of political authority, that it's very difficult to find one encompassing figure who can make everyone else rally around them.
You're absolutely right, Gavin. You know, the part of the problem is that I think an unintended consequence of Barack Obama being president is that a sizable part of white America believes that, well, we had a black president twice, right, two terms, therefore racism isn't a problem. And I think that a sizable part of America, and I would argue that a lot of this is President Trump's base, they believe that we're colorblind. And every quality of life indicator in the United States of America tells us otherwise. What we're seeing right now, you know, the triple hit, one is the pandemic. We have 20 million people that are unemployed in the United States. And if you look at that, disproportionately brown and black. And then we have, of course, police brutality, which is disproportionately affects brown and black people. But if you're white in the United States and you're middle class, you live in a white bubble, your church is white, your social networks are white, you're probably in a white suburb with good schools, and you're immune to these things. And you've come to believe, they placated in some ways, that, well, I'm not racist, my life is good, therefore it must be good for everyone. And I think that this has been an awakening in many ways, that white America and many people that read understand that there's systemic inequality. But you just let it go. You let it go by. You live your life. And I think now, I've been to two protests that have been, I've never seen something so interracial, so intergenerational. And that said, when I was walking with my wife and my neighbors, there was a man in a convenience store parking lot screaming at, you know, it's children, it's old people, it's ministers, it's black, it's white. This man screaming at people walking by, F you, F you, F you. And I'm thinking, wow, what is this about? There is a chunk of America that is just thoroughly racist. And unfortunately, some of these people are police officers, and they are politicians, and they are people that are basically important community leaders. And this is the purge that has to happen. So there's a lot of work to do. But again, I went through Rodney King. I've been through Michael Brown. I've never seen anything where there has been people coming together to say that we need to have systemic change in the United States.
And maybe that might be what is different this time, that sort of broad coalition of allies that there are. But on the topic of white allies, you mentioned there that a lot of people don't feel that they, you know, that racism is really a prevalent problem because they themselves don't feel racist and because they don't envisage it in their own corners of the world, that they don't encounter it and therefore they don't think it's really there. Is part of the problem that in order to properly address all of these inequalities at a societal level, you have to force people to take some sort of command of a society and to address a problem that they literally can't see? And that's going to be inherently difficult when you have people who've grown up in privileged areas, who've never encountered racism, who don't believe they're personally responsible for it, and therefore don't really know what to do to try and address the problems of others.
Yeah, that is, you know, that's a great point. And I think what made this so different, and I'm sure you and your listeners, everyone has watched in horror, you know, literally watching the life be pushed out of this, of George Floyd. You know, and I'll just say this, that I went to two different peaceful protests, and both the ministers had everyone sit for 8 minutes and 46 seconds. And Gavin, it felt like it was a century. It felt like I was sitting there for an hour and a half, and I thought to myself, my Lord, you know, this is what this must have been like to have your knee on your neck for 8 minutes. And my point is that I think what has happened is that there is the visuals were so shocking that I think that there's been an awakening of empathy. And that is what had to happen, because otherwise it's abstract. And I live in a bubble myself. I'm in a middle class, upper middle class white neighborhood. I'm in a very blue part of the state of Pennsylvania. You know, people are all overeducated. They all read the New York Times or the Wall Street Journal. But there's complacency. And I think that people of good conscience and good heart have just said, oh, yeah, you know, we have this thing called institutional racism. I'm hoping it'll go away. I think that what's happened now is that there's literally been an awakening. And again, I'm not being overly optimistic about this. I'm watching what's happening. And I'm watching people that I know have been apolitical are now saying, vote people out of office, get involved with your church or your synagogue or your mosque, and do something. So I really like to believe, you know, the old line in the United States is that, you know, the liberal experiment is that the system is self-correcting. Well, the system only self-corrects when there's a time of crisis. And I don't care if it's the 60s. If you look in American history, it's only during times of utter disorder where the kind of systemic changes happen. I don't care if it's the Great Depression or it's the civil rights movements in the 50s and 60s. You need to have basically something like this, where you protest, where violence happens, to start to change the system. Otherwise, it's just same old.
What institutionally then has to change? Because not only do you change people's minds, and you might have now people who are awakened to this problem that they were previously blind to, that they are now sympathetic towards fixing. How do you change it? I mean, obviously there is no silver bullet, but there's such a big judicial architecture. There's so many different levers of political power. How do you go about even starting to address a problem like this?
Yeah, and this is why one of my criticisms of President Trump. After Ferguson happened, the federal government, through the Department of Justice, went into Ferguson, and they did a top-down review of their policing. And what they found was racial profiling. They were ticketing people. They're literally generating revenue by basically zero-tolerance offenses. They were filling their coffers by basically targeting black people with minor fines, which become larger fines because they couldn't pay them. Basically, the federal government. There is no national police force. There is no national organization that oversees police. It's literally tens of thousands of police departments all over the United States. And some of them, quite honestly, are run like fiefdoms. You know, if you're a chief of police in a small town, you're a god. You can do whatever you want, and you can protect your people, that is, your other officers. What needs to happen is federal oversight. And we did it in the 60s and 70s. We had the same kind of police brutality. I grew up with someone infamous, this Mayor Frank Rizzo in Philadelphia. If you were black or brown or gay, you had no civil rights. The federal government came in, and they did oversight. So it starts with the police unions. It starts with this blue wall, right? The line of the blue wall is that you never rat out. You never speak against a fellow officer. That has to change. We're seeing that already, that it is changing, that officers are saying, no, we do not stand with these people that they're abusing their power, using excessive force. We need to have people that are the prosecutors. Prosecutors are so fearful of police unions because police unions are powerful. We need juries. A jury typically sides with police officers. So what we need to do is we need to change the culture. And the culture changes have to start within the police departments. And it has to start with basically rethinking the whole idea of qualified immunity. Officers need to be held accountable. And I should say this also, Gavin. I run a criminal justice program. My students go on to become officers in the CIA, the FBI, ATF. And I think that they are different than officers 30 years ago. I think they're more empathetic. I think they're more thoughtful. And they're more professional. And that kind of professionalism has to basically come to every single police district in the country. It has to start with the unions, and it has to start with basically changing the culture where other officers are able to say to that one officer, the bad apple, who is thoroughly racist, to say that this behavior is unacceptable, or to testify against him. We have something called testifying here in the United States. People lie on the stand. Officers testify. Okay. They lie for a fellow officer. They'll lie to get a conviction. And it has to start at the level of policing.
Charles, I'm sorry to cut you short. I'm afraid we're completely out of time, but really appreciate your time this morning, especially because it's so early where you are. Charles Gallagher is professor and chair of the Departments of Sociology and Criminal Justice at LaSalle University in Philadelphia.